Tom Weber on NPR News. Next up, Untouchable. That is the name of a documentary premiering tonight in Minnesota at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Film Festival. It explores laws around the country on sex crime and the laws we have in this country around making sex offenders register with authorities and the limits we place on where sex offenders can live and work. This film focuses a lot on work to pass new laws in Florida, but there are prominent voices from Minnesota in the film as well, including Eric Janus from Mitchell Hamlin School of Law in St. Paul. Janus has been on this show a lot to talk about sex offender policy. He's written and spoke about this as well. Also in the film is Patty Wetterling, whose tireless advocacy for the safety of children is so well known in this state ever since her son Jacob was kidnapped in 1989. We only learned last year that Jacob was killed the night he was taken. The man who killed him is now in prison. Patty Wetterling has fought for some of these laws, although she actually starts to question some of them in the movie as well, and has done so as well publicly. The film premiered at Tribeca. It will be screened tonight at 7 o'clock at St. Anthony Main Theater in Minneapolis. The film's director, David Feige, joins me now. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Eric Janus is here as well from Mitchell Hamlin. Eric, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Tom. Thanks.
Your questions this hour, 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. You can tweet me at WeberTom1. And please don't call or text if you're driving. So, David, you are a lawyer, actually. You've been a public defender. You've done a lot of commentary.
Yes.
This is your first film. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
By the way, how do you go from arguing cases to saying, this is the topic I want to dive into the world of film with?
Well, I had lived with this subject as a... I was a public defender, mostly in the South Bronx at the Bronx Defenders. I was the trial chief there for a bunch of years. And so I watched firsthand as these laws evolved from being strict to being draconian to, in some instances, seeming almost senseless. And so I watched this from my perch as a lawyer, and as I transitioned out of that, first writing a book and then creating a TV show called Raising the Bar with Stephen Bochco that had sort of explored similar territory, at some point I turned around and was like, yeah, maybe I could make a movie. And
I'm sure plenty of people listening have said that before in their lives as well. Right?
Well, I got lucky.
Everyone can make a movie.
Yeah,
right?
Turns out, you know, everyone can, although I'll tell you, it takes a lot of work and a lot of time. But this was always a topic that I had wanted to explore. And in large measure, it's because I'm drawn to what I think of as the hardest stories. As a public defender, I was sort of drawn to the toughest cases. And the truth of the matter is, especially now at a moment where there's real retrenchment in how we see the criminal justice system, I think there is a growing ease with some of the, you know, some of the topics that before would have seemed odd. Innocence, the war on drugs, mass incarceration, sort of there are lots of films. Those are doable. Mm-hmm. The one that wasn't, the one that was, you know, to put a word on it, untouchable,
yes,
was sex offenders. It was sort of the darkest corner of the criminal justice system. It was rife with problems and injustices, and that was where I wanted to go. I wanted to make the movie I thought nobody else would make.
You know, the word untouchable comes up with the idea of, you know, kids should be untouchable in the most, you know, horrible ways that we think of when we think of sex offenders, but also this topic.
Right.
This topic is untouchable in many ways.
It is, much to my chagrin. I mean, and so, and by the way, you know, I stand up in front of audiences before we show the film, and, you know, you always want to say, you know, enjoy the show. it's not the kind of thing where you go and it's necessarily an enjoyable experience, but I hope that though it's a hard film, it becomes a hard film to forget. Because once you go in and look around, it kind of rocks your world.
Is this a biased movie? Is this a biased movie to say you should now be against sex offender laws or sex offender policy?
That's a great question. No, no. And I think what I've found and what I tried to do was make a film that started a conversation. I think that polemical films that suggest solutions, and there are no solutions suggested in the film.
Right.
It's deeply in the lives of the characters and focuses enormously on how they live in the world. And it looks at both sides of the issue, both from the victim's perspective, mm-hmm, and from the perspective of people on the registry. And it pulls you back and forth so that you sympathize despite yourself with both sides. And at the end, my experience has been that audiences are really churned up and have an enormous number of questions, really want to talk about it, and that's what I wanted, was to start the conversation.
Eric Janis, I will agree with that. I mean, the if nothing else, you capture and have this essence of the emotion on all sides of the issue.
Yeah, what I think is the genius of this film is that it is...
Is that you're in it. No, I'm joking.
No. And you know, quite honestly, when I first got a call to be interviewed, I'm a little hesitant about that because I know that some of the things, positions I take and my views can be unpopular or could be put in an improper context. So I looked into David's background and I saw that he looked like a very trustworthy person. And in fact, I think the film is a nuanced look at this whole thing, and it humanizes it. It doesn't sensationalize. And most important, it does start conversations.
What's the thing? I mean, you're one of those guys, Eric, for lack of a better phrase, who's been screaming from the rafters for a while. And I don't know to what extent people have been listening, but what, from your perch, what are we missing writ large when we hear the word sex offender and try to start a conversation about sex offenders?
We're missing two things, really. At a human level, we're missing the humanity of all the people involved, and I'm including the sex offenders. And that's one of the things this film does. Without being soppy, without sensationalizing, without pandering, it shows three sex offenders as very human, flawed, but human beings. Mm-hmm. And I think we just can't forget that. We need to start thinking about it, these laws in that way. The second thing it does, and that I think we're missing, is to think about what are the unintended consequences of these laws that we've been passing. I think we've been thinking about these laws as, well, if they help one person, they're good. But really, they have much broader impact, and we must begin thinking about the net impact of these laws and whether that net impact actually helps prevention or, on the other hand, impairs prevention efforts.
What would you add to that?
I think that's a great point. I think that's exactly right. And look, in a way, that goes against the entire reductionist narrative of today. We live in a time that to some extent rejects nuance and rejects science and rejects thoughtful complexity. And look, that is where the film tries to go, and to say, hey, wait a second, let's just look at these laws and what their net effect is, and then think about whether they make sense. And the film is, in many ways, underneath it, a meditation about power and politics and about voice and voicelessness and about how when you have a reviled, voiceless minority, and it'd be hard to find a more reviled and, you know, more voiceless minority than sex offenders. Nobody speaks up for them. Whatever that minority is, it becomes very, very easy to just kick the bejesus out of them and do anything because who cares? They're not going to they've got no voice.
But they are sex offenders. Why don't we kick some of that to the curb?
Well, by the way, you can kick the sex offending part to the curb. The question is, if you do it in a way that is counterproductive and increases the likelihood that the very outcome you're seeking to avoid actually happens and increases. In other words, if what we're trying to do by, as you would say, kicking them to the curb is stop, say, recidivism, if we're passing laws that are actually counterproductive and increase recidivism, they may feel good, but they're not good policy. And that's complicated. And that's something that Eric has looked into. And it's why he's such a wonderful voice and a thoughtful, even-keeled voice in the film, is he says, look, I've done the research. Here's what it says. And that's why it's so and that's why his voice is so valuable in the film.
David Feige is with me, the director of this film, which is called Untouchable. Eric Janis here, who's in the film as well, from Mitchell Hamlin. They will be screening it tonight at St. Anthony, Maine at 7. And then afterwards, there'll be a panel discussion with David and Eric and also Patty Wetterling, who is in the movie. And Patty is just so well known here in Minnesota for all the work she's done since her son Jacob was kidnapped, and we learned last year. So the film actually was filmed before we knew Jacob had died.
Yeah, I think we were one of the very last interviews Patty did before they you know,
before they learned what had happened.
Yeah.
I have a little compilation here because Patty's going to be at this event tonight. So there's this panel discussion. She couldn't be here today because she's traveling. But here's a little compilation of what you hear from Patty in this documentary. Again, filmed before we had learned what happened to Jacob. But she also notes in this documentary that the law she pushed for so much after Jacob was kidnapped was to have sex offender registries, but not public registries. Her initial goal was to say, let's have registries that police can use between themselves and not make those names public.
After building this, passing it in Minnesota and working on the federal law, right before it was to be introduced was when Megan Kanka was kidnapped and murdered by the neighbor. The family felt that it wasn't okay to just let law enforcement know where these people live. We should all know. So that became community notification, and that's Megan's Law. What it feels like sometimes is that the intention of that law got hijacked and it went down another path. People forget the goal. We want them to never offend again. So to do that, we should be giving them treatment, and then they need a place to live, they need a job, they need social support, continued treatment, and we take all of those away, one by one by one.
Eric, we've talked, and that's Patty Wetterling in the movie. Those are some clips from the movie that I put together there. Eric, and we've talked about this, Patty Wetterling is, for better or for worse, the face of the worst possible thing that can happen to a parent in Minnesota. And she is now questioning, 27 years later, some of the laws she supported.
Well, she's questioning where they've gone.
Where they've gone.
What they've evolved into. And I completely understand and agree with what you said about the original intention of these laws. They're quite conservative, and they are originally designed to give law enforcement a better tool. Now they've evolved into very broad laws that sweep very broadly, have public notification, and go beyond that in terms of restricting where sex offenders can live, what kind of jobs they can have, and so forth. All of these things that, as David has said, are very clearly counterproductive to the goal of reducing sexual violence and recidivism.
This is a weird tangent, David, but have you seen Arrested Development?
No.
I bring it up because there's actually a joke, a line of funny in the most recent season that has to do with sex offenders, believe it or not. And blah, blah, blah. The Bluths own this tract of land and this subdivision that nobody's buying houses for. And the sex offenders realize that it's the only place in the state where they can live and everyone moves in.
Right.
So, so they're trying to make funny there. Then I watch your documentary. Those places actually exist.
Oh, absolutely. They exist all over the place.
A trailer park in Oklahoma.
Trailer park in Oklahoma. There's a tiny set of cabins outside of Lake Okeechobee in Florida. And then there's a parking lot where we filmed a chunk of the film in an industrial zone in Miami, which is one of the only places in Miami that is compliant.
Laws say you can't live within 1,000 feet or 2,000.
2,500 feet in Miami.
Of a school.
And then they included bus stops and parks. And then at some point, you know, it becomes very, very easy to respond to the not in my backyard preferences by passing broad ordinances and driving people out. So in Miami, there is almost no compliant housing. And as a consequence, there is this parking lot where they actually – when you're released, they tell you, oh, you got to go there at this corner and you got to be there. And there are over 100 registrants.
Sleeping in tents.
In tents, on cardboard boxes, or just on the floor, literally just lying on the ground. There are no facilities. It is this wasteland out there. And that's where we put them. And, you know, the problem with that is that, as Patty said, stability helps. These people are, many of them are going to get out of prison. Stability helps them. And creating homelessness and instability winds up, as Eric talks about beautifully in the film, winds up being counterproductive.
Clyde Newton is one of the people we meet in the film who lives in that parking lot. He touched his stepdaughter sexually when she was 7, and he was sent back to prison on a technical violation of his release because he was under curfew to be back at that parking lot. The bus he needed to catch to get back there was late, and he was 8 minutes late for curfew, which resulted in 4 additional years of prison.
Yeah. One of the things when I started digging into the numbers about why people go back to prison, one of the things that I was astonished by was just how few new sex crimes were being committed and how many people, 90% of them, were being sent back for technical violations. And what was amazing about Clyde was I met him the first night of the shoot of the film. We literally show up at this parking lot. And we're looking around, and I'm literally walking around. It's 11 o'clock at night, and I'm saying, hi, I'm David Feige. I'm going to make this movie about, you know, would you be willing to talk to me and just tell me sort of how you wound up here and what happened? And, you know, we had, I think we only had one light with us. You know, we weren't really even planning to shoot. And I'm talking to Clyde, and he tells me this story about how he just got out of prison after 4 years for being 8 minutes late. And I'm a public defender. I'm like, uh-huh. So what were the other technical specs? What were the other specs on the complaint? He said, no, there weren't any. And I said, no, I know that maybe you only pled to one, but, you know, and I'm completely skeptical.
Yeah.
And he looks at me and he says, no, do you want to see my papers?
And he showed them to you.
And I say, I very much want to see your papers. And I grab our DP. We set up a light. I'm like, you got to shoot this. He goes off, rummages in literally his only possession, which is a backpack, comes out and hands me his appeals papers. And I'm looking them over and it says, yeah, he was 8 minutes late. And they gave him 4 years. And the court said, yeah, that's reasonable.
Here's the thing, Eric. One of the characters in this book we meet is Ron Book, a multimillion dollar lobbyist whose daughter was victimized by their nanny. I mean, it's a horrible situation to be in, but this is his crusade now.
Right.
At one point, Ron Book says, I believe there is a certainty that pedophiles will reoffend. Is he correct?
No, he's totally wrong. That's the fiction that has been promulgated. With aided and abetted, by the way, by the courts, by the Supreme Court, but it's a fiction. And one of the key problems is these laws are enacted in a fact-free zone. There's a lot of social science, a lot of data now that shows us actually that the rate of reoffending of sex offenders is actually fairly low, by no means a majority or even, you know, a third of sex offenders reoffend sexually. So we have passed a set of laws on a faulty assumption that almost all will reoffend, when in fact a great majority will not.
We're talking with Eric Janis and David Feige about this movie, Untouchable, which will screen at St. Anthony, Maine tonight at 7. Eric and David will be part of a panel discussion afterwards with Patty Wetterling. Let's take a call here from Al in Eden Prairie. Hi, Al. Go right ahead.
Yeah, good afternoon. I've got a quick question for you. I've been kind of following this, you know, the sex offender situation for a number of years, you know, just peripherally. And I want to start by saying that, you know, it is a horrible crime. It is a horrible situation. But I've always found it really curious, especially in Minnesota here, where you have a situation where a person has done the crime, has done the time, immediately gets out and gets locked up civilly with, you know, until just really recently, no possible chance of really getting out. It just, it seems just at its base, something wrong. I mean, if this crime is so bad, you know, like I told the person who took the call, I said, you know, just for lack of a better term, just man up, legislature, and say, all right, this is as bad or worse than murder. These people are going to go away forever and, you know, be done with it. But it seems so disingenuous to say, okay, you do the crime, then you get out, but you don't get out. You get stuck in this place where, for all intents and purposes, you really aren't going to get out. It doesn't seem like an American way at all to me, at least in Minnesota. That's how we seem to be doing it. So what do you guys think about that?
Al, thanks for the call. And just a brief note here. You're talking about civil commitment, big topic here in Minnesota. That's actually not part of this movie per se. But, I mean, there's so much else
not,
you have to get
but
to.
But I have to tell you, we followed the case here for several years. The problem with making a movie is at some point it has to end, and it generally has to end within, say, 100 and some odd minutes, and then everybody tells you to make it shorter. So we had a full chunk of the film that followed this litigation, that talked to Dan Gustafson. We followed Dan Gustafson.
Here in Minnesota.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, and Civil Commitment was a huge part of it because it does seem so Alice in Wonderland. That like, wait, I'm sorry, we're going to lock you up not for what you've done, but for what you might do. And we're going to make this special exception for sex offenders. And then we're going to say that it's for treatment when everybody knows it's punishment. And we're going to say you have a chance to get out when everybody knows you never get out. That was great stuff. And unfortunately, it's on the cutting room floor.
Maybe on the director's cut or whatever. But does
the DVD
extra. The other way of asking Al's question, though, is, well, then why not just say it? Why not just say this is the most heinous thing you can do, therefore it's an automatic life sentence?
Well, I have a couple of thoughts about that. First of all, here in Minnesota and nationally, criminal sentences for sexual crimes have gone up. They've doubled over the last several years. So, yes, that has happened. But as long as you have this option of locking people up after they finish their sentence, I don't care how long the sentence is, it is going to be used in certain situations.
Ron Book is a major figure in this movie, and he's just someone he's really interesting to learn. And he is a father on a crusade because his daughter was so horribly victimized.
Yeah.
Would any of the laws that Ron Book has advocated for, if they had been in place before, would they have prevented his daughter from being abused?
Well, I think, as you know, there's a moment in the film where I pose that very question to him at the end, and I'm inclined to say, go see the movie to see what his answer is.
Then let me throw the same question.
Could probably guess.
Would the man who killed Jacob Wetterling, who had not yet been convicted of any crimes, would Jacob's kidnapping have been prevented, Eric, if any of these laws that are now in the book had been on the books then?
Well, the answer is no, in part because these laws only apply to known sex offenders. And one's tempted to say, based on the work, of course, that the APM has done,
the In the Dark podcast,
that had the resources that have gone into sex offender commitment, that have gone into registration, notification, had they gone into basic law enforcement, that might have made a difference.
But the thing I'm getting, David, is that all the laws across all the states, and Florida definitely has some much, much more stringent laws than Minnesota, they don't seem to be focused on preventing the crime to begin with. They seem to be focused on what to do with people who are convicted. Does the wider public get that? Does the wider public realize that these laws actually are not at all designed to prevent sex crimes?
It's a great question. But the answer is no. But the reason has to do with sort of the broader way we think about these things, right? When was the last time you saw a headline that said X number of rapes prevented, 50,000 cars not stolen? I mean, that's just not how we see things. What we do is, and look, let's lay this in some respects at the feet of the media, which is we wait for the really, really horrible, unbelievably rare case.
Like Jacob Wetterling.
Like Jacob Wetterling. Like, you know, the one guy who has the girl locked up in the shed for 15 years. And we make that the point. And we make that the reason that we pass these laws that wind up affecting huge swaths of people that they were never really intended to talk about or target.
One of the people we meet is a woman in Oklahoma who was 18 when she slept with a 14-year-old, as a sex offender. She's also a mom. So when Oklahoma passed a law recently that said sex offenders can't go to parks, she can't take her kids to the playground anymore. Just a little bit of that nuance David was talking about. We're at the end of the hour here, but David Feige and Eric Janis will be at the St. Anthony Main Theater tonight at 7. This movie screening at that time is called Untouchable. They will be part of a panel discussion afterwards, and Patty Wetterling will join them as well. David, Eric, thanks so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
More at nprnews.org.